Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're zoning in on someone who's been, well, a key player behind the scenes in American comedy for, what, over two decades now?
Absolutely. A real architect, you could say. We're talking about Alex Sulkin.
Right, Alex Sulkin.
Yeah.
And his influence is, I mean, it's deeply woven into the fabric of modern animated comedy, especially everything surrounding Seth MacFarlane.
That's a great way to put it, the MacFarlane verse. While maybe you don't know the name Alex Sulkin off the top of your head when you're watching Family Guy or, you know, heading out to see a big summer comedy, His fingerprints are all over it. He's been a core engineer of that very specific, often controversial, but undeniably successful style of humor.
So our mission today, looking at all this material we've gathered, is to really get under the hood. We want to map out his career path, understand how he got from point A to point B.
Yeah, how does someone go from the pressure cooker of late night writing to basically running one of the biggest animated shows ever? And at the same time, translating that Family Guy sensibility into blockbuster movies, it's quite a trajectory.
It really is. And we also have to tackle this kind of split in his public image, right?
Exactly. That's crucial here because the sources show this massive success story. On one hand, leadership, creative influence, longevity.
But on the other,
his own public comments, specifically on social media, sparked, well, a huge international controversy.
So we're going to unpack all of that, the creative triumphs, the public persona, the controversies, and how it all fits together, or maybe doesn't quite fit together.
Yeah, how do those things coexist, and, you know, what does it tell us about his career and maybe the industry itself?
Okay, let's dive in. Where do we start? The beginning, I guess. The foundation.
Makes sense. Let's start with the basics. Alexander Matthew Sulkin, born February 14th, 1973. He went to Connecticut College.
Okay. Standard enough background. But the real launch pad, according to our sources, was his first big writing gig.
Right. The Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn. And importantly, he was there for the first 3 years of the show.
That feels significant. Why is that particular show at that particular time such a key starting point?
Well, think about late night back then, late 90s. It's basically comedy boot camp.
Right. High pressure.
Extremely high pressure. You're churning out jokes constantly. Topical stuff has to land tonight. It's relentless. You learn to be fast, versatile, and you learn to kill your darlings, you know. Jokes that don't work, gone.
So it drills those fundamental joke writing muscles, the speed, the punchline focus.
Exactly. Skills that would be absolutely essential for the kind of rapid-fire, cutaway-heavy style of Family Guy. He learned structure, pacing, just the grind of finding the laugh day in, day out.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. He got that network TV grounding before jumping into animation. But the sources really highlight how he got that job in the first place. It wasn't just applying cold, was it?
No, not at all. And this is like the key connection that unlocks everything else. He was recommended for the Late Late Show job by Wellesley Wild.
Wellesley Wild. Now, that's a name people might recognize, especially if they follow Family Guy or the Ted movies.
They absolutely should, because that recommendation, that connection, it's the bedrock of Sulkin's entire professional life, really.
It's the start of this decades-long writing partnership.
It is. Wellesley Wild became his go-to collaborator. That relationship is the engine behind so much of his success. It's a classic Hollywood example, isn't it? Building an empire on a trusted inner circle.
Yeah, MacFarlane clearly relied on this core group, Sulkin and Wild, being right at the center.
Totally. They became indispensable to that whole operation.
And that trust, built early on, paved the way for the next big step, animation. The sources mention he worked on the Cleveland Show, too, which kept him in that MacFarlane orbit.
Part of the ecosystem.
And then the main event, joining Family Guy, officially in 2005. And that's where things really take off.
Right. Now we're getting into the heart of it. Section 2. His role in building the Family Guy empire. Since 2005, he's been doing, well, pretty much everything there.
He wasn't just writing scripts.
No, far from it. He's listed as a producer, or writer, obviously, but he even does voice acting for some recurring characters. It shows just how integrated he became in the show's DNA, top to bottom.
And looking at the list of episodes he's credited on, it's not just the length of time he was there, it's the kind of episodes he seems to have been involved in some really significant ones.
Yeah, let's dig into some of those because they really illustrate his range and influence. You absolutely have to start with the Star Wars parody. He wrote the first part, Blue Harvest.
Which was a huge deal at the time, right? An hour-long special.
Massive. Think about it, 2007. Handing a writer the reins for an hour-long parody of Star Wars, that's enormous trust from MacFarlane and the studio.
Both creatively and financially, I imagine.
Absolutely. Blue Harvest wasn't just another episode. It needed complex writing to nail the parody and the Family Guy humor, plus all the production coordination, the music. It was almost like making a mini movie.
And it worked. It became iconic for the show.
It totally did. It proved Family Guy could pull off these huge, ambitious, high-concept swings. It showed Sulkin could handle that scale.
But he wasn't just doing the big event episodes. His name is also on episodes that feel like classic Family Guy absurdity, like Chick Cancer or Steroids.
Right, and those show his mastery of the show's bread and butter. Take a kind of outlandish premise, Stewie on steroids, Lois getting cancer, which sounds dark, but they spin it for comedy, and build a typically irreverent half hour around it.
So he could do the core show formula just as well as the big specials.
Exactly. But then you also see things like Stew and Stewie's Excellent Adventure, which gets into time travel, more complex plotting. He showed versatility there, too.
Interesting. And then there's an episode that, well, it definitely sparks some debate. Screams of Silence, the story of Brenda Q.
Ah, yes. That one's fascinating. Tackling domestic violence, focusing on Quagmire's sister, Brenda.
That feels like a huge tonal shift for Family Guy.
Yeah, it absolutely was. For a show built on shock value and, let's be honest, often making light of serious topics, to suddenly pivot to something so heavy, so grounded, it was a massive risk.
What does him writing that tell us?
It tells us he was willing, or maybe the show running team at the time was willing, to push the show into really unexpected territory, using that huge platform for something dramatic, almost like a totally different kind of show.
How did people react to that episode? Was it seen as a successful experiment?
It was really divisive. Some critics and fans praised the attempt to address a serious issue. Others felt it was jarring, like it betrayed what Family Guy was supposed to be.
Right, that tonal whiplash.
Exactly. But whether you liked it or not, it shows Sulkin was part of making bold, maybe even controversial, creative choices within the show itself, not just, you know, writing standard jokes. He wasn't afraid to experiment with the format.
And that experimentation extends to things like the viewer mail episodes too, right?
Yeah.
He co-wrote the second one.
Yeah, those anthology episodes require a different skill set, juggling multiple stories, different tones, all within 22 minutes. He could handle that, too.
The sources also list episodes like Into Fat Air, kind of an adventure parody, Grim Job, Doing Fairy Tales, Three Acts of God. It's just a remarkably consistent output over such a long stretch.
Consistency and versatility, that's the takeaway. He wasn't just a one-trick pony. He could handle parody, adventure, character stories, even heavy drama, all within the Family Guy voice for over a decade.
Which leads us to the big so what moment in his animation career, the power shift.
Precisely. All that work, all that demonstrated expertise, it culminated in a major promotion. Starting with season 16, Alex Sulkin, along with Richard Apple, became the new showrunners for Family Guy.
And showrunner isn't just a fancy title, is it? It's a fundamental shift in responsibility.
Oh, it's huge. We need to be clear what that means. A showrunner, especially on a long-running hit like Family Guy, is basically the CEO of that show.
Right.
You're overseeing everything. The writer's room, the animation pipeline, the budgets, the actors, keeping the brand consistent, keeping it funny after, what, nearly 20 years on air by that point? It's an immense job.
So McFarland essentially trusted him, along with Appel, to steer the ship, to run this incredibly valuable property.
Exactly. It's the ultimate vote of confidence. He went from being a key writer and producer to being one of the top executives responsible for the entire creative direction and, frankly, the continued profitability of a flagship show for Fox, now Disney.
A massive transition. But his story wasn't just contained within Quahog, was it? While he was building this empire in animation, he was also making significant moves elsewhere.
That's right. Section 3, expanding beyond animation. And this brings us back to that crucial partnership with Wellesley Wild.
Because their success on Family Guy opened other doors. Big doors.
Very big doors. Their collaboration was so effective that studios started investing in them as a team. In August 2010, Sulkin and Wild signed a big 3-year overall deal with 20th Century Fox TV.
Okay, break down what an overall pact means for listeners who might not know the industry jargon.
Sure. An overall deal is basically the studio saying, we believe in you guys so much, we're going to pay you a hefty salary for the next few years, and in return, we get the first look at anything you create.
So the studio is betting on their future output.
Exactly. They're betting millions that this duo, Sulkin and Wild, can generate new hits, potentially beyond animation. It's a signal that they've moved up from being staff writers to being seen as major creative players, potential show creators in their own right.
And that bet paid off pretty quickly and pretty spectacularly with the move into feature films.
It sure did. The big one, of course, was Ted in 2012. Sulkin co-wrote the script with McFarlane and Wilde.
And Ted was huge. Not just financially, but it felt like a moment.
It absolutely was. It proved that the specific comedic sensibility they'd honed on Family Guy, that edgy, pop culture savvy, kind of juvenile, boundary-pushing humor, could translate to a live-action movie and find a massive mainstream audience.
It showed the McFarlane-verse wasn't just an animation thing.
Precisely. It cemented McFarlane, Wilde, and Sulkin as a bankable movie writing team. And naturally, they followed it up by co-writing the sequel, Ted 2, in 2015.
They didn't just stick to talking teddy bears, though. They tried other genres, too, right? Like the Western?
Yeah. A Million Ways to Die in the West in 2014. Same writing team, McFarlane, Wilde, and Sulkin.
Applying that same comedic lens to a very different genre.
Right. Trying to do for the Western what Ted did for, I guess, the buddy comedy. It wasn't as big a hit as Ted, critically or commercially. But the fact that the studio gave them the resources to make a Western comedy shows just how much faith they had in that team's brand at the time.
But it wasn't all smooth sailing in the live action world. There was also the sitcom attempt.
Ah, yes. Dads. This is an important counterpoint to the Ted success story.
This was 2013. Sulkin and Wilde produced it. McFarlane was an executive producer. It seemed like it had all the right ingredients.
On paper, yes. The core creative team behind Family Guy and Ted doing a traditional multi-camera sitcom for Fox. You'd think it would be a slam dunk.
But it wasn't.
No, it was canceled after just one season.
What does that tell us?
Well, it's a really stark reminder that success in one medium doesn't automatically transfer to another. Animation is different from film, and both are very different from network sitcoms.
Different rhythms, different audience expectations.
Totally different. And the broadcast network environment is notoriously tough. Maybe their specific style, which worked so well in animation and R-rated films, just didn't quite fit the constraints or demands of a primetime network sitcom. It shows even this powerhouse team wasn't immune to failure.
A good reality check. Okay, one more feather in their collective cap before we move on. The Oscars.
Right. When Seth MacFarlane hosted the 85th Academy Awards, who did he bring along to help write jokes?
Let me guess. Sulkin.
Sulkin indeed. Along with Wellesley Wilde and a bunch of other Family Guy stalwarts, Julia Sharp, Danny Smith, John Wiener, Patrick Mayan.
Writing for the Oscars.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big stage.
It's about as big as it gets in terms of televised events. Being tapped for that means the industry sees you as a reliable, high-level joke writer who can deliver under immense scrutiny.
It's sort of like the ultimate validation of their comedic skills recognized by the mainstream industry.
Absolutely. It shows that the Family Guy sensibility, or at least the writers behind it, had achieved a certain level of institutional acceptance, even respect. At the highest levels.
No. Okay, so we've tracked this incredible professional rise, late night, animation domination, blockbuster films, Oscar recognition. It's a remarkable trajectory.
It really is. Consistent success across multiple platforms driven by that core partnership.
But now we have to shift gears.
Yeah.
Because alongside all this professional success, there's the other side of the coin. The public persona and specifically the controversy, Section 4.
Right, and this is where the modern reality of being a creative really comes into play. The sources note that Sulkin built up a pretty significant following on Twitter.
Which many writers and producers do now. It's a way to connect with fans, share thoughts.
Exactly. But it also means your personal, maybe unfiltered thoughts are broadcast instantly to potentially millions of people. The line between the writer's room and the public square completely dissolves.
And for Sulkin, that led to a major incident in March 2011. We need to carefully unpack what happened with the tweet about the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami in Japan.
Yeah, this is obviously sensitive territory. First, the context is vital. The 2011 Tohoku event wasn't just an earthquake. It was a triple disaster, massive quake, devastating tsunami, and the Fukushima nuclear crisis.
The scale was just horrific.
Unbelievable. Over 15,000 people confirmed dead, hundreds of thousands displaced. It was a moment of profound global shock and mourning. Rescue efforts were ongoing. The world was watching in horror.
And the timing of Sulkin's tweet.
Yeah.
When did it happen relative to the disaster?
According to the sources, it was posted just one day after the earthquake and tsunami hit, literally while the crisis was still unfolding in real time.
Okay. And the tweet itself read, "If you want to feel better about this earthquake in Japan, Google Pearl Harbor death toll."
Yeah. The intent seems to have been some kind of dark, historical, maybe politically charged humor. trying to contextualize or diminish the tragedy through a historical comparison.
But the delivery.
The delivery, connecting an immediate, catastrophic, ongoing natural disaster where thousands were dying to a historical military attack like Pearl Harbor, and doing it just 24 hours after the quake, it landed disastrously.
An incredible lapse in judgment regarding timing and sensitivity.
To say the least, especially given the sheer scale of the human suffering happening at that exact moment, it just hit all the wrong notes immediately.
What happened right after he posted it? What was the immediate fallout?
Well, the backlash was swift and severe, global, really. The next day, he deleted the tweet.
And he issued an apology.
Yes, he issued an apology stating the post was insensitive and that he hadn't, quote, realized the extent and severity of the disaster.
But the damage was done. Why did this particular tweet cause such an uproar compared to, you know, other edgy online jokes we see all the time?
I think there are a few reasons. One, as we said, the sheer humanitarian scale of the Chikku disaster made sensitivities incredibly high. Two, remember 2011, Twitter was really hitting its stride as a global news and commentary platform.
Right, things could go viral very quickly, maybe before people fully grasped the implications.
Exactly. And public figures, companies, they were still figuring out the rules of engagement online. How do you balance personal voice with professional responsibility? The response here was intense, sustained, and got picked up by major news outlets worldwide.
It really highlights this modern dilemma for creatives, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
In the past, a writer's edgy joke might get filtered out in the writer's room or by network standards. Now, a late-night tweet is instantly linked to your professional identity.
Absolutely. Sulkin was already a known producer on Family Guy. Suddenly, Alex Sulkin, private citizen on Twitter, and Alex Sulkin, key creative for a major Fox Disney show, were inseparable.
And the network, the studio, they have to deal with that fallout.
They do. They have to weigh the public relations damage against the value of the creative talent. It forced a very public reckoning with the consequences of a joke that, you know, probably never would have made it onto the actual show.
And yet, and this is maybe the most surprising part of this section, despite this huge public controversy, his career didn't stall. In fact, it accelerated in the years after 2011.
That's the really striking thing the sources reveal. He weathered that storm, kept working on Family Guy, co-wrote massive hit movies like Ted, which came out the next year, and eventually, years later, was promoted to showrunner.
Which says something.
Yeah.
About how these things are weighed in the industry.
It certainly raises questions about accountability, forgiveness, and the perceived value of proven talent versus public perception.
Okay, let's round things out before we get to our final thoughts.
Yeah.
Section 5. Just a few personal details and the overall synthesis.
Sure. Just to add a bit more dimension. The sources mention he's Jewish, which, you know, might inform some of his comedic perspective, given how Family Guy often plays with cultural references. He's married to Tal Rabinowitz. They have one child. And an interesting little tidbit connecting him to the wider comedy world. He apparently dated Sarah Silverman at one point.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, she's obviously another comedian known for pushing boundaries.
Right. It just helps paint a picture of someone embedded in that specific comedy scene for a long time.
Okay, so let's pull it all together. What's the big takeaway for someone trying to understand Alex Sulkin's career based on these sources?
I think Sulkin really embodies this modern pathway for a successful comedy writer. You start in the trenches, like late night, prove your joke writing chops.
Right, build that foundation.
Then leverage connections and talent to get into a hit show like Family Guy. You demonstrate versatility and reliability over years, maybe decades. And then if you navigate it right, that leads to creative leadership, like becoming a showrunner.
And crucially, while doing all that, you're also trying to branch out, in his case, very successfully into feature films.
Exactly. And the constant factor, the engine behind so much of that upward mobility, seems to be that core partnership with Wellesley Wild, operating under the broader umbrella of Seth MacFarlane's production world.
He found his creative home, proved his worth within that system, and was rewarded with immense trust and responsibility across different mediums.
Yeah, it highlights how valuable consistency and adaptability are, but it also shows the power of loyalty and established relationships within these successful creative teams, perhaps even insulating them to some extent from external criticism.
All right, that seems like a good place to wrap up our deep dive on Alex Sulkin. We've covered the grind, the creative output, the huge successes in animation and film, and also the very real complexities and consequences of being a public figure in the internet age.
Yeah, the material really paints a picture of just how demanding the comedy industry is now. You need to be able to write a quick gag for TV, craft a story for a movie, manage a huge production. It's not just about being funny anymore.
You need to be a writer, a manager, an innovator, kind of all at once.
It's impressive he managed to climb to the top of Family Guy while also co-writing blockbuster movies. That's a rare balancing act.
It truly is. But that brings us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to chew on. We discussed the intense global backlash to that 2011 tweet, criticism from major organizations, media outlets worldwide, a serious public relations crisis.
Right.
Yet in the years that followed, Alex Sulkin wasn't sidelined. He continued to work, his film career exploded with KED, and ultimately he was promoted to the very top creative position, showrunner, at the company that faced that backlash.
So the question is,
what does that outcome tell us about accountability in the entertainment industry today?
Mm-hmm.
How does a corporation weigh proven creative and commercial success against past public controversies? Where is that line drawn, and does achieving a certain level of success change where that line sits? A really interesting question to ponder. Does consistent delivery, does making the company money, ultimately outweigh a public offense in the long run? That's a calculation happening all the time in Hollywood. Okay, that's all the time we have for this deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
Until next time.